Good morning, everybody. It is September 27th, 2021. Monday, I am back from camping. We had a fantastic weekend out there under the tall pines in the fall, smell of campfire smoke drifting all across the campground and extremely quiet. I love fall camping. You don't get the bustle, you don't get the noise. And you also don't get the bugs. Blessedly bug-free up there. And with the campground so empty, you can do some fun things. We took all the kids, put them in the back of the pickup truck, drove them around the campground for a modern hayride. It was great. We caught little bike reflector fish off the shore. The dog had a lot of fun. Tried to knock over the tent a couple of times, but she enjoyed herself a lot. So, interesting that then I come back. No cell reception up there, right? This is campground, but real camping. No phone reception or anything like that. And I check out what's been going on in the world. And of course, by the world, I mean the internet. And lo and behold, I see that Scott Alexander the Great, has a topic up, a new post that is near and dear to my heart. Folks, not since Alex Tabarrok posted the question, why wasn't Dungeons and Dragons invented much earlier, has a blog post resonated more with me. Because, well, for one thing, my poem Council is about this very topic that Scott posted. And this is a topic that I think is extremely important. It has been something that I've thought about and answered, by the way, with a theory that I do not see anybody else talking about. And so that's what I'm going to share with you here. Talked about and answered to my satisfaction by me 30 years ago, honestly. So to see Scott post about this, I was very happy because, like I feel now, the world is a little bit more like I expected maybe as a teenager, right? I remember as a teenager reading through books like Human Action or Atlas Shrugged or Stranger in a Strange Land, and I just lifted my eyes up off the page and I just moved them around the library. I spent my last 2 years of high school mostly in the library. The teachers were great, were absolutely awesome, and they completely realized that I would learn way more in the library than I would learn in their class. Not every teacher. I had some great teachers who it was better for me to spend time in class with them. But a lot of my teachers were like, yeah, why don't you do an independent study in the library during this time? And I was like, I agree. So I spent a lot of time there, and I would pick my eyes up and I would just look around the room, and I couldn't believe that the world was as it was, right? Because I had already discovered some of these things for myself, and I was planning on spending my life sharing these ideas with people. And then I see that, you know, Mises and Rand and Hayek and Heinlein, these were the big things. You know, I'm forever grateful to whoever stocked my high school library with those books. I had figured out by like age 15 or so that the golden rule was flawed, and that selfishness was very often a virtue. And I was just strolling by one time, and I saw the virtue of selfishness from good old Ayn Rand there on the shelf. And I said, holy cow, what is this? Somebody else has this idea already? And then I would read through these books, and I would look up, and I frankly couldn't believe that the world was still the way it was when these ideas were out there. And I was like, okay, well, if these guys couldn't convince the world, well, to heck with it. Maybe I should just go play video games or go spend time with my friends, because The world clearly doesn't want these ideas that would put it into what I would consider a more happier place, a more advantageous place where kids don't die as much and adults don't die as much. You know, immortality would be a great thing. Eternal youth. And I couldn't believe that nobody else considered old age to be a disease. Finally, though, finally they are starting to consider old age a disease. And by they, I mean Google and Calico and many other biological gerontology researchers. And so just like that, I feel a little bit more involved. And I'm seeing some of these things start to perk up again. So let me just share with you my thoughts on this topic. So Scott Alexander, the topic that he posted is basically, why does modern art suck? And he's including modern architecture with that too. In fact, he might even lean slightly more heavily on modern architecture. They are, of course, very related questions, but somewhat different. There's a distinction between the two, chronological and otherwise. We'll get to that. This is probably going to be a two-part podcast, by the way, because I do have this other life that I've been leading and working on for the past few decades, and it's a pretty darn good one. I mean, it has s'mores, right? That's good. So I'm going to have to go do that, but I will get back to the rest of this podcast, to the rest of this episode tomorrow. But we will get to the main thesis here today. So Scott posts, why does modern art and architecture suck, right? And by modern art, we're talking about highbrow stuff, highbrow painting, highbrow sculpture, highbrow music, highbrow poetry. Architecture, for example, like I.M. Pei or Frank Gehry. We're not talking about the art, the modern art of, say, Elder Scrolls Online, which is, in fact, gorgeous. You should play it. We're not talking about something like the art of Star Wars or Buffy the Vampire Slayer, right? These things are modern, but just like they said of Robert Frost, he has nothing to do with modern poetry except for the fact that he is a great modern poet. And the same can be said, right, of things like Star Wars and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. They have nothing to do with modern art except for the fact that they are great modern art. No, we're talking about poetry like maybe Angle of Geese by N. Scott Momaday, or the Anna Livia Plurabelle passage, right, from Joyce, or Ocean Vuong, or maybe these Rauschenberg collages, right, that look like the front of my refrigerator if only all my schools, my kids' school assignments were about rust and the failure of the Industrial Revolution, capitalism, or something like that. And Dave Barry put it really well, right? He said that modern sculptures look like helicopters that have crashed and burnt themselves out and that no one has ever bothered to come back and clean up. So, yeah, that's what we're talking about here. And there are absolutely borderline cases, right? Like you talk about Elena Ferrante's Neapolitan novels. You know, those are considered to be super great art. And they're pretty good. They're not like, you know, Dos Passos' USA trilogy or something like that. But on the other hand, the Neapolitan novels are no Twilight Saga, which really is great art. Fight me if you think otherwise. We'll have to come back to that some other time. But look, Scott Alexander, he's a gem. He is absolutely a fantastic gem. He's a pirate chest full of gems. He has so many classic essays out there. He has taken down the FDA recently and a long time ago when he talked about the drug approval process. And, you know, his Beware the Man of One Study essay is something that I emphasize constantly to my classes in school. He's just fantastic. But unfortunately, he whiffed a little bit on this one. He came really close, in parts of it, but he kind of took a swing and missed on this particular essay. He does give us some nice data, Right. He quotes a National Civic Art Society survey where people say that they prefer classical architecture 70% to 30%. And yet, 92% of all federal buildings are modern. 92% is very high, y'all. Right? 92%. Sometimes if I'm doing a test proctoring and I wander around the room and I try to keep my mind from falling asleep, or I try to keep my mind active, and I'm looking around and I do little surveys, right? I say things like, how many kids are wearing sneakers? How many girls are wearing ponytails? How many boys are wearing shorts on this 90 degree day sweating in the gym? And even with dominant fashion trends like that, sneakers or jeans or something like that, I hardly ever get 92%. So 92% of modern federal buildings being modern, that is really high. Some more data, this isn't in Scott's piece, but some more data just to emphasize the problem to you. Nielsen ratings, right? They say that the radio reaches about 270 million listeners, 270 million, not necessarily distinct people, but audience listens per week in 2019. And then in a separate survey, we have 28 million listening to NPR each week. So NPR doesn't even necessarily focus exclusively on highbrow stuff. But if we use it as a proxy for that kind of, we're talking, you know, under 90%, maybe 80%, 85% preferring pop of any sort versus highbrow in terms of the radio and listenership there. Also, you can just sort of look, it's anecdotal, but just look, when is the last time you heard of an NEA grant going to a garage punk band or a League of Legends caster? No, they don't. The NEA grants go to people who build whistles out of their grandmother's sheepskin rug or something like that. You can look at just like Sirius XM to continue the radio model. Sirius XM, they have over 100 channels, but only one classical music channel, right? That's obviously less than 1%. And on that classical music channel, they play way more Beethoven and Liszt and Bach than they play Cage and Glass and Britten and Poulenc. Although I do have to say I can appreciate Glass sometimes, and I actually like Britten and Poulenc, especially like the motets and the ceremony of carols and stuff, especially around Christmas time, obviously. I'm just saying that it's clear from the numbers that there is a split here, and it's clear from the numbers that the vast majority prefer Guns N' Roses. So we do have an issue here. We have this split between highbrow and lowbrow art, and that is unusual. And Scott comes up with some ideas to explain this. His first idea is that maybe the rich, instead of flaunting wealth, are hiding it in architecture, and that this is necessary because of the Great Depression. No one wanted to be seen as super rich, or because of various economic developments in the 20th century, it wasn't quite as cool to rub the little guy's nose in the fact that you're rich and he's not. So that's the first possible explanation offered here, is that there's this shift from flaunting wealth to hiding it. But that doesn't hold water. And even Scott Alexander kind of acknowledges that it doesn't hold water. I mean, come on, nobody is hiding their wealth by putting their massive giant mansion behind a hedge. People are still going to see it as a massive giant mansion. And the other thing is, if you're talking about Great Depression as part of the economic development that led to this, that's long after, we're talking, you know, that's 1929, 1930s, long after painting and poetry had succumbed to modernism, for example. Number two explanation that he offers is that the elites wanted to be more separate than ever. The elites just decided they needed to form more of an elite class than ever, and they became more out of touch than ever. There's some problems with this idea, right? That, first of all, that's not what the elites say that they want. The elites nowadays, and even back then, were talking about equality, and maybe they're lying, but I still don't think that we could put too much stock in that, because the general process of civilization since the Industrial Revolution has been that the elites and the masses have, in some senses, been getting closer, right? If you look at the elites now, they have the same phone in their pocket that I do, right? They watch the same movies, play the same video games. For the most part, we have access to the same knowledge. And so this idea that the elites are more out of touch than ever, that they become more separate class than ever, I don't buy that. And I'm not sure that even Scott Alexander buys that as he's writing through here. The elite could, right? If they wanted to drive a completely different phone market, if they wanted to, they could. And they could establish some sort of phones that none of the rest of us could have access to. They could fund troops of actors. It could be the thing, right? To have your own troop of actors, like the Lord Chamberlain's men, on a stage in your giant mansion, and have them play for you every night, and no one else would get to see them. The rich could do that if they wanted to. Instead, the billionaire people that I know, I have been fortunate enough to, you know, teach some kids. They were then, and they're billionaires. And, you know, my friends, I guess they're my friends, they sit on the dirt at Coachella. So they're not forming their own society, separate or break-off society. I'm not buying that. The next explanation offered is that modern is actually just better, and we're just wrong. We think it looks bad and it functions poorly, but it actually is better, and the experts know better. I mean, this is definitely not the case with Frank Gehry's building at MIT. If you've never been to MIT to see this monstrosity that they thought was a good idea, it's okay, because you probably have a Dr. Seuss book on your shelf. Just open that up and look at the buildings that Dr. Seuss draws. That's what Frank Gehry inflicted upon MIT's campus. I like MIT's campus. I like it. I like the river going by there. I think it is pretty cool. But then I round the corner and I see this Dr. Seuss thing sitting there, and I just get crushed, because what the heck? What is that thing? And it was leaky, right? It was full of leaks. It was required way more maintenance than a similar building would have. And they had to spend millions, I think, afterwards. I'm pretty sure it was in the millions to get it up to a state where it wasn't dripping on the heads of all our super smart young scientists there. Oh, extremely disappointing. So I'm not buying that. Now, yes, older buildings do require more maintenance in some cases, but maybe that's just because they're old. And if you think about, certainly in painting and poetry, the paintings and the poems that people know and respect and use as touchstones of culture, role models to inform their own lives, standards of beauty, to the extent that poetry and painting are the things that people use for those anymore, people don't use modern ones for that. They go back. They go back to things with rhyme, to things that aren't part of this modern turn. So that's not the correct explanation either. Number four, Alexander talks about Baumol's cost disease. In other words, relatively increasing costs of labor while other fields have benefited from technological advances that increase their productivity or their efficiency. That really doesn't make sense for poetry or painting or sculpture when you're just comparing within the discipline itself. There's no relative disadvantage to producing one type of poetry versus the other type of poetry. Now, one is not more labor intensive than the other, not for sculpture. You could maybe look at this for architecture, but I'd have to check. I have to believe gargoyles are pretty cheap these days, right? I have to think if you wanted to get a bunch of gargoyles or some fretwork or some intricately patterned friezes, you could do that. So again, not quite buying it. His last explanation here is so close. This is where he's basically right. And a lot of the commenters on there were like, yeah, I always kind of assumed that that was it. The last explanation is really close and just about right, but not quite. So the last explanation is that there's this split between art and mass culture because we have a change from signaling wealth to signaling taste. Well, it's definitely true that there's a split between art and mass culture. And this change from signaling wealth to signaling taste, he's so close. He says in this one sentence, with the invention of photography and printing, everyone could have realistic pictures whenever they wanted. And actually, then the rich needed better ways to distinguish themselves. The rich wanted to be seen as different from the poor, and that is what is driving this turn. Well, that is very close, but it reverses things. It's focusing on the rich, and certainly the elites were necessary, were a big part of what happened, but it's reversing things. It's only looking at half the equation, and it is getting the order wrong. Let's go back and see which way the order actually proceeded. Let's take painting. We're going back now to the middle of the 19th century, and we're talking about imagining that you're a painter, right? You are part of a rich tradition of art and math, engineering. Look, seriously, look at the learning that went on in painting from 1400 onwards. Materials, perspectives, even optics, right? Like the Arnolfini portrait by Van Eyck. You're part of this tradition. You're proud of that tradition. It's been getting better and better, this art, this selective recreation of life. And then you're sitting down with some of your painter buddies. And as Joe Haldeman Jr. says, when you get artists together, they don't talk about art, they talk about paintbrushes. Critics get together, they talk about art. Artists get together, they talk about paintbrushes. So you're sitting there with your buddy and talking about paintbrushes, and he says, Hey, you hear about this new thing called a photograph, right? Or a stereograph or a daguerreotype or whatever they're calling it back then. And you say, what's that? And he proceeds to tell you, and he tells you that there's this new device that can get a picture, and it is the perfect image, the very realistic, photorealistic, the actual capturing of the light of the image of the real life. And how is that going to make you feel? Well, you're going to be a little bit put off by that, a little bit unsettled by that. Now, photography, some say, is not really its own art. That's hogwash, of course. Photography is its own art. It's separate art from painting. But these painters in the middle of the 19th century, seeing these photographs coming and getting better and better and faster and faster and easier to reproduce and capturing more light and more light, they've got to be looking at that and thinking, holy sacre bleu, mon son of a motherless chèvre, my whole thing is going away. This is my raison d'être. What is happening? Who will hire me to do portraits now? Who's going to hire me to do a portrait? They can just take a picture, right? And even more importantly, for an artist, not just who's going to hire me to do a portrait, who's going to pay my bills, far more important for an artist is who's going to sing my name throughout history. as a supreme artist. I need that immortality. I need to be on museum walls. But now there's this photography thing doing all this. What the heck? We've been working through this tradition over centuries, you know, since Greek art sort of fell, Roman art sort of fell. You went to the Middle Ages. It was trash compared to Greek and Roman art. Then they recaptured this going into the Renaissance. Since Byzantine times, getting better art, more realistic art, more realistic art, more back to the Greek way of capturing the ideal form. And then this technology appears, which is going to do all that for you. It's just going to capture that form right off the bat. And as a painter, you're going to be a little bit worried, right? And that fear, that worry, that panic, to be honest, that feeling of being threatened kicked in the response among painters to saying, oh my gosh, I can't compete with this photography, so I need to redefine myself. You know what? I need to distinguish myself from this. How am I going to be on museum walls? How am I going to be immortal? Well, it's not because I'm painting things that you can see in real life. Of course not. No, because that's what mere photography does. No, in fact, what painting is about, it's not about realism. It's not about representation at all. It looks like we've been going towards that, right? For the past five centuries, it looks like we've been building towards that. That was all just silliness. What's really important is to draw stick figures with three heads playing guitars made out of snails. And paint splotches. Paint splotches are important too. You can't do that, photographers, can you? Not too many stick figures with three heads seen from five different angles playing guitars, right? It's not a mistake that these ideas that came up in painting were very different from the capabilities of a camera. And then, after that, that's where the patrons come in. That's where the elites come in. And they go along with this because they trusted the painters. The painters are elite and among their discipline. And the patrons said, oh, you are the experts. You must be right. So look, for example, at Impressionism. This is the first movement away from realism, a major movement away from realism in painting. Mid to late 19th century, exactly the same time that photography was coming out. And it wasn't the lingering monarchs of Europe or some budding titans of industry that went to Manet and Seurat and said, hey, you know what I really want, what I would like to pay you to do? Could you please paint me some smeary, blotchy, dotty things instead of this other stuff? That other stuff that I've been saying for the last 50 years that I really want and that I've been buying from you for the last 50 years? No, I changed my mind. I want this other stuff. No, that is not what happened. The patrons did not go. The elites of capital, the elites of finance, the elites of wealth did not go to the painters and say, hey, please start doing this. No, the movement came from the painters themselves, and it was born out of fear of this new technology. And we'll explore in more detail tomorrow in the second part exactly how the patrons took it from there and how the money enabled this and how it proceeded. But that was the start of the split right there. It did not come from the rich, and it was not fundamentally about the rich. It was fundamentally about psychology and fear and this need for immortality. And the painter saw that photography was on the horizon. Ultra-realism was being stolen from them. They were threatened. And so they decided to throw out completely what they had been working on for a long time and go in a different direction. That's the split. Now, as Sabina Hassenfelder would say, the power of a theory is in its predictive or explanatory power and efficiency. In other words, how much can your theory predict and from what size framework? Can it explain a lot based on a little. Can a couple, a single few ideas produce a great deal of explanation, accurate explanation, and accurate modeling and forecasting? Well, I think this theory does, right? The idea or the theory that I'm saying here is that this movement was led by the artists because they feared losing their art. They feared losing their chance at immortality. They feared losing their chance to do what they must do, which is produce art. It was being stolen by, all those chances were being stolen by technology. And so the art world was, the art world's reaction, the artist's reaction was to revolt, to turn around, to go against this in the face of this catastrophe. They turned around and walked in the other direction and completely went away from this sort of representational art that a lot of people see the skill in and recognize the value in, toward paint splotches and refrigerator magnet collages. So if my idea that this is a reaction to technology, emerging technology by artists, and that's what's causing this, if that idea is true, then we should be able to use that idea to explain other phenomenon in the arts as well. Can we? The answer is yes. Absolutely. Let's take poetry. This is the next best example. Certainly it's the one I am most familiar with. So look at the end of the 19th century in poetry. Just as you have photography coming onto the scene for painting, you have the phonograph and sound recording coming onto the scene to threaten poetry. 1877, Edison really started the sound recording industry. Of course, as always, the French will claim that they did it first. But really, Edison kicking things off in 1877, the recording industry starts, the first popular song recordings about the year 1900, and then really popular type stuff like the every living room must have this type stuff. That wasn't until the 1910s. So the poets saw this, right? They looked around, they saw this coming, and they're like, ooh, well, the child is father to the man, and this little recording industry child, that's going to be giving birth to one heck of a giant, fearsome, poetry-killing man. Egad, what do we do? We are supposed to be the singers, right? Imagine you're a poet. You've been singing. You've had this monopoly on recorded music for as long as there has been writing, or really as long as there has been an oral tradition. And you've been invoking the muse to help us sing ever since the millennia, ever since the Iliad, four millennia. Well, what do we do now? Oh, you look around, and painting had already had this impressionist movement going on, and that seems to be working out for them. We'll get into tomorrow a little bit more on how the patrons and the elites supported and enabled this. But the impressionist movement was going on for the painters, and the poets were kind of like, I'll have what they're having, right? We have a technology that's stealing our songs, just like they had a technology that's stealing their images. So they called their movement Impressionism, and Ezra Pound, dear old fascist Ezra Pound, swoops in and says, hey, yeah, Impressionism. You know what our movement is called? Imagism. And it's called Imagism because, guess what? Yeah, you know how poetry has been talking about song and about sound and about the muse singing in them for untold centuries, and we've had all this delicious rhyme. Yeah, poetry's really not about that. It's about image. Image. Could you think of an odder topic for poetry to be about? Just completely divorced from sound, obviously taking some cues from Impressionism, and it worked because the poets and the English professors, they all were like, ooh, that is a good idea, right? Air of mystery makes us seem cool. And so then you had this movement starting. But today, we'll get into more of the mechanics of how it proceeded tomorrow, but today, I'm just trying to emphasize for you the piece that, again, Scott Alexander, who is awesome, he's one of our best intellectuals, but this piece he just missed in his summary there, talking about it coming from the rich. No, it came from the artists themselves. Case in point, right? You had Harriet Monroe. Harriet Monroe, founder of Poetry Magazine, she was driven by a need for immortality. She feared not being, she was terrified of not being famous. Today, she'd be one of those desperate YouTubers out there, probably, and probably a very successful one. And Harriet Monroe, driven by this fear, really needed to do something in poetry, do something to make her name immortal. And she did. She succeeded. Great credit to her. And she founded Poetry, right? The Magazine of Modern Poems. For years, Poetry listed their ideal poem or the poem that they wanted to see more of, right? You would look up in one of those old writer's guide to poetry market books or something like that. And what did Poetry Magazine want to see? Well, for years, Poetry Magazine would quote Eliot, and they would say that what they want to see is, let us go then, you and I, through certain half-deserted streets while the evening lies slumped out against the sky like the patient etherized upon the table, which is an awesome image, but it's not exactly the raven when it comes to sound. So Harriet founded this magazine, 1912 Poetry, and how did she found it? She didn't found it because the elites or the rich came to her. In fact, what Harriet did was she went around to Chicago, and I think it was $50. She asked rich people, or maybe it was $5. I think 50. She asked a bunch of elites, a bunch of rich people, to pledge $50 to this new poetry magazine because this was what poetry should be about. This was the real deal. This is what poems should have. We should have, you know, things like Eliot and things like Pound. And that's where poetry was really headed. And she had to convince them. It's not like the rich went to her and they said, hey, Harriet, you know what we really need from poetry? We need you to found a poetry magazine that includes a lot of really obscure Hindu chants, Datta, Dayadvam, Damyata. That's what we need in poetry. No, that did not happen. It was the other way around. Harriet went to them. And Harriet, of course, in thick with Pound and all the rest of them. It's impossible to underestimate, by the way, if you don't know, the influence Pound had on other artists around him, including, to some extent, Frost, although Frost resisted and resented later Pound for trying to influence Frost in at least some respects. So it was not the people of Chicago, the rich people of Chicago, coming to Harriet and saying, we need this. No. Harriet sold them on it because Harriet was in this milieu. She was hanging out with all these just glittering people, and they needed to get their new idea of poetry out there. And so she sold them on investing $50 each in this new magazine, Poetry. And they did. And it worked. And that example is even better, by the way, because if you look at what's happened with the Poetry Foundation and with Poetry Magazine since then, it just bears it out even more, right? Because in 2002, Ruth Lilly, heir to the Lilly pharmaceutical fortune, gave Poetry Magazine $170 million. And she didn't do that because she was paying them to switch or to create some new type of art or to be elite as separate from the masses. She did that because she was told all her life that really good poetry was the type of poetry that's in that magazine. And she submitted herself, Ruth Lilly, many times to Poetry Magazine, rejected every single time, never published in Poetry Magazine, but she still gave them $170 million because she had been sold by the poets themselves, by the editors of Poetry Magazine themselves. Ironically, I think the editor at that time was Christian, and he was Wyman, and he was very traditional, I guess is the right word, even formalist compared to many of the recent editors. But she did. Ruth Lilly donated all that money because the poets went to the elites, not the other way around. And that's how that's going to play into architecture, which we'll get into tomorrow too. And that's how this whole modernist turn began, because the threat of technology, the threat of taking away immortality, the threat of taking an art and moving it into merely a copy, merely a rote procedure. Of course, that's not how it turned out, but that didn't matter. All that mattered was the perception of the poets and of the painters when they saw these new technologies on the horizon. They are the ones who panicked, and then they went out and sought the elites and changed things in their art. And we will get to tomorrow the ramifications of that and how this parallel other market showed up, the mass market, the pop market. But that will have to wait until tomorrow. But I hope that I have sufficiently demonstrated to you today the predictive power of my model and how it explains what happened with poetry and painting. And those were really the first two arts to begin this modern turn. And we will follow it up tomorrow. In the meantime, have yourself a wonderful day. If you were out camping this weekend too, I hope that you can still taste those s'mores and smell that campfire smoke. That's what's helping me get through this Monday, as well as some delicious thoughts about art and philosophy and this wonderful world that we live in. Take care.